Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision. Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Each week, we take a nonpartisan dive into topics related to the federal budget, the economy, and how it all affects our nation's future. This week, we'll get some policy ideas from three college students who recently took part in an annual fiscal challenge competition where teams from around the country devise and defend their own plans for putting the federal budget on a sustainable path. For some expert perspective on these plans, I'm joined by Concord Coalition National Field Director Phil Smith and Chief Economist Steve Robinson, both of whom attended the competition finals in Washington, D.C. on Friday, April 12th. Also joining our discussion is Mike Aguilar, founder and president of the Fiscal Challenge. Dr. Aguilar is professor of economics at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also associate professor at UNC Chapel Hill's Kennan Flagler Business School and adjunct associate professor at Duke University's
Fuqua
College School of Business. He's also, earlier in his career, he worked at the Congressional Budget Office. He holds a PhD in economics from UNC Chapel Hill and lots of other degrees. And you can tell from if you were watching us on TV, he's got lots of equations in the background on his whiteboard behind us. Anyway, Mike, Phil, and Steve, welcome to Facing the Future.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for having us.
All right, Mike, you've been on our show before because we like the Fiscal Challenge is one of our annual events, kind of like the Boston Marathon, which is being run the day we're recording this show. You know, for us, it's really interesting to look at the plans that the student teams come up with. But you founded this Fiscal Challenge a few years ago. Could you give us a little bit of background on, you know, what the basic idea is and what you hope students get out of it?
Thank you for having us on the show, not just for me, but for the students as well. It really gives them a voice. And that was one of the main reasons why I started this. It's a educational nonprofit. Started it back in 2013. When I was teaching, what I found was that we do a lot in college academics, public policy, economics departments, et cetera, on monetary policy, not a lot on fiscal policy. So I started a nonprofit with the goal of enhancing students' understanding of fiscal policy. So the way we do it, in which you were kind of hinting at, Bob, is every year we have a competition. Experiential education, I think, is the best. So what we do is in the fall, when the students get back from their summer breaks, I put out a call to action. And I say, very simply, solve the national debt problem. And they actually have the fall and the first part of the winter to devise a plan. These are tremendous plans. And I think the three students you'll have here today will really give some great details. They work throughout the fall. They maybe will work, if they're lucky, with a faculty advisor. And they'll develop their plan. Specifically, I asked them to do this. Take the debt to GDP ratio, stabilize it over the next 30 years, you know, those long-term CBO baseline projections. And they submit their plans to me in usually about early to mid-March. And I review them. I pick the top six and I fly those top six to DC. We get a room of heavy hitters in the policy space, and they defend their plans. It's a great educational experience.
And, you know, I know that the challenge evolves over the years, not so much the challenge itself, but the plans. Have you noticed any trends over the years in the types of policies that the student teams concentrate on?
Yeah, that's really great. There was two things I noticed this year. One was political feasibility, and the second was growth. So political feasibility, you would think it's a divisive election. Maybe they're more cognizant of that. What really surprised me was growth. The target variable is debt to GDP. It's a fraction. And often in the past, students would focus in the numerator. I raise some revenues, I spend some dollars, but they often would overlook the dynamic effects for the denominator, right? Numerator and denominator. And so this year we had tons of great supply side stuff, investments in transit, investments in broadband, human capital, apprenticeships, immigration, green cards, universal pre-K. That was one of the major new themes from this year that I saw, not in every team, but across many of them.
You know, that's interesting because about a month ago, I did a forum at the University of New Hampshire School of Law, Franklin Pierce School of Law, and it was focused on immigration. And, you know, we were a co-sponsor, the Concord Coalition. And so I, you know, part of my role was to explain to the audience why a budget group was interested in an immigration forum. And it was because of that reason you said it was the that GDP factor. Phil, yeah. I wanted to get you in on this because you play a role in the fiscal challenge as the moderator and interacting with the student teams. Do you find any similarities from the budget exercise that you run across the country as Concord's field director? You do a budget exercises, which, you know, people are invited to on one day come together and do a bunch of options that we give them and they make choices between them. So it's a lot easier for that sort of thing. But do you notice any similarities between that and the plans that the students come up with?
I do. At the Concord Coalition, we run our federal budget exercise called Principles and Priorities all around the country, and it gives people a chance to build their own 10-year federal budget. So in this case, the students were looking at a little bit longer time window. But the one thing I will say that's in common with the fiscal challenge and the Concord Coalition's exercise is the broad-based way that people look at it. When you look at the budget, a lot of people come with like a silver bullet solution, right? Mm-hmm. You can just fix all of this if you cut foreign aid. And of course, you know, whether you're for foreign aid or against foreign aid, there's not enough foreign aid, you know, to fix all these big problems. So they look at everything, both on the revenue side and the spending side. They look at reforming some of the largest programs in the federal budget, like healthcare. You know, you really can't solve the federal budget challenge long-term without doing something about healthcare, right? And then the healthcare cost growth. So a lot of the students looked at that. It was impressive to see their Social Security proposals. As I get closer and closer to that retirement age, the Social Security trustees numbers start getting more and more personal. So it's great to see young people realize that, you know, these reforms are going to be needed in Social Security since it's such a big part of the federal budget. And so they brought forth lots of interesting ideas about Social Security reform. But to Mike's point, it was very interesting to look at the dynamics they were looking at. They didn't just look at their proposals in the cold cutting room floor. You know, they looked at what would it do? Like if you cut here or if you increase there, what would the repercussions be on our society, both in the short term and the long term? So I was very impressed. And as you know, when you work in these budget issues for so long, it's easy to get a little depressed, you know, because nobody in Washington's doing anything. So it gives me great hope for these students to do what no modern president and no modern Congress has been able to do, which is assemble a sustainable federal budget.
Steve, let me bring you into this because you interacted with the students after the presentations or while they were waiting to have their plans evaluated. Did you get a chance to, I mean, just like overall as our chief economist, were there policy options that, you know, stood out for you, surprised you, impressed you?
Well, yeah, I mean, the one thing I did notice, I think, and I may have missed one, but I think all the plans, one common element, there seemed to be a universal support for the carbon tax. Mm. And I suspect not only is it a big revenue raiser, but obviously, you know, folks are worried about climate change and global warming and those sorts of issues. So I suspect the unifying theme of I think virtually all the plans was a focus on the carbon tax. You know, they all had a healthy mix of revenue changes, as well as you know, a focus on spending, largely, of course, entitlement programs, Social Security, Medicare are the big drivers of future federal spending. And of course, you know, everybody's always concerned about the defense, Department of Defense, the defense budget as being bloated and perhaps larger than it needs to be. And so there was a pretty universal focus on those as well. So, you know, as Phil suggested, once you look at the numbers, people are generally not inclined to think that there's one silver bullet like foreign aid that we can, you know, fix the entire budget. So you have to come to this process with, you know, a fairly wide range of policies on both the spending side and the tax side. And that is, in fact, what we saw.
In other words, they did all the things that Congress doesn't do.
They have to make the trade-offs and the policy choices that members have so far refused to do. Yeah, that's right.
You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, Concord Coalition National Field Director Phil Smith and Chief Economist Steve Robinson and I are talking with a group of students who have been working on a plan to bring about a sustainable federal budget. And we'll be right back to hear more about it after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Concord Coalition Chief Economist Steve Robinson, National Field Director Phil Smith, and I are talking to students who recently competed in the National Fiscal Challenge competition, and they were trying to come up with plans that would stabilize the debt-to-GDP ratio. I want to bring in the three students that we have on the program today, Akash Banerjee from Temple University, Jacob Anthony from Notre Dame, and Alexei Shilov from Northeastern. Akash, let me go to you first, and just tell us a little bit about where you are in school, why you decided to get involved in this project.
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for having me, Bob. Really appreciate it. Yes, I'm a graduating senior at Temple University. I'm studying economics with a math minor. And last semester, got a random email in my inbox that said, hey, there's this big case competition going on. It gives you a chance to kind of apply everything that you've been learning, compete against some really good schools. So I looked at it and I thought, well, Temple's never done this before, and it seems like something that would be right up our alley. So I pulled a team together and here we are today.
That's terrific. And I should mention your team was the first place team this year.
Yeah, thank you.
Okay, so next is Jacob Anthony from Notre Dame.
Yeah, so I am a current junior at Notre Dame studying economics and math. And Notre Dame's had an established program in Fiscal Challenge for a while. And it's my third year doing Fiscal Challenge. And when I was a freshman, I came in really interested in economics and economic policy, but not really sure how to actually get involved in doing this. But sort of at our club fair and through meeting some different people, I was able to get involved in the fiscal challenge. And I've learned a lot over the last 3 years about budget issues and fiscal issues and how to sort of balance all these concerns. And it's been a lot of fun.
Our third student guest is Alexei Shilov from Northeastern. You were in third place this year. 2 years ago, you were in first place and you are on the show representing the team. So, aside from that, what should we know about you?
Yes. So I'm a graduating senior as well as Akash is, and I studied computer science, which is not a usual background at this competition. But I always found an interest for myself in economics and especially following the budget process and how those issues affect me. And I found about this competition very randomly at one other club meeting, where a member there said, hey, there's this very cool thing happening. Would you like to join to do some fiscal policy? And said, oh, why not? And here we are 3 years later doing this for the third time in a row.
That's great. Well, outreach certainly helps. So let's go back to the Temple team and Akash, and tell us a little bit about your plan.
Sure. So we didn't want to just bring down the debt to GDP ratio for the sake of bringing down the debt to GDP ratio. We wanted to do more than that. And so we started off with kind of like a fiscal philosophy, if you will, with some policy goals of self-sustainability and structural stability, And then also modernity and adaptability, and then empowerment and equity. And so we wanted to build a kind of a future that we believed would benefit all Americans and kind of lift us all up rather than just simply balancing the budget, which is also important. But there's a lot you can do along with that. And one of the key themes of our policies is that they work together so that, so for example, our carbon tax revenues, we reinvested into clean energy tax credits. And so we try to make our policies connect and lift each other up to build this future that we want to see for this country.
And just briefly, did you find in making the those trade-offs and choices, I mean, were there any sticking points that were particularly difficult within the group? How did the dynamic work?
Yeah, so we, being a smaller team, we were both advantaged and disadvantaged. The advantage was that we had more time for deliberation, but the disadvantage was that we had more time for deliberation. And so we we argued a lot. And one of the key sticking points was, how do we make these policies both legislatively feasible, but also impactful? And we got a lot of caution from advisors and from people we received feedback from, like, don't hit the third rail, don't hit like Social Security, Medicare. And then we got other advice from others that, you know, you can't do this without hitting those. So figuring out, how do we approach these very sensitive topics that we know we need the political will to do something about? And how do we formulate policies that benefit not just both sides of the aisle, but also the key stakeholders involved? Because ultimately, it's not just Republicans and Democrats that are disagreeing. Republicans are disagreeing because they have certain voter bases, and Democrats are disagreeing because they have certain stakeholders that they try to serve more than others. And so we try to like filter down and see, okay, who are the underlying stakeholders that would cause these policies to be more or less politically feasible?
I think that that dynamic sometimes takes place in Congress, probably not often enough. It sounds familiar. Jacob, to you now on the Notre Dame plan.
Yeah, so our plan, kind of how we structured it, was around this theme of like back to the fiscal future. So we kind of took this track of looking at it from the idea of, let's go to 2054. We've reached this, you know, great society where we have all these, you know, this balanced, sustainable debt to GDP ratio, sustainable spending. What else do we want to see there? How did we get there? What were the steps that we actually took to get to this point? And we knew this couldn't be like an all-in-one go. It wasn't something where you could just be like, here's this one giant mega policy that we're going to pass right now that's going to fix all our issues. This was going to be, it's a really difficult problem, something that has a lot of different issues that go into it, as Akash was saying, a lot of stakeholders, a lot to consider. So it was something we thought about, a policy rollout over the next 30 years and some sort of path we could put the country on that would get us to a sustainable level of debt to GDP. And so this kind of looked like, okay, what do we do need to do in the first period, which is we needed to get hit some of the really big things in the first period, get some of these growth drivers growing, going, such as immigration, getting Medicare kind of under control and some of those entitlement reforms, and then continuing to go from there, continuing to give people time to adjust to these changes while also moving forward with some of our other policies. And then finally, as we came to the end, getting to do some things that we wanted to do. We feel like we need that this country really puts into, really could benefit from things like universal pre-K that we feel could really boost the well-being of the entire country while potentially being a spend that we can't finance right now.
Yeah, I noticed that you had a lot of the, you certainly didn't ignore the third rail, any of those third rail thing. So let me ask you, were there particularly difficult policy decisions within the team from Notre Dame?
Yeah, so actually, funnily enough that you mentioned the third rail, we did actually have one third rail that we ended up taking out, which was a big data tax. And that was kind of the biggest sticking point between the team. It was something that I was in our first round presentation, but not in our final presentation. And what this was it was a tax on sort of data collection by companies. We feel like a lot of corporations are just collecting data willy-nilly. There's not really a cost associated with any of this data collection. So it's something that we felt potentially would be a good for American consumers to actually start putting some costs associated with this and incentivize companies to do more with the data they have and think about what's actually providing value rather than just collecting all the data they can on individuals. But ultimately, we felt at the end of the day, AI and some sort of the rise of these productivity boosts is just so important to our central economy that there was actually some third rail that we weren't able, that we didn't want to go quite to that point. But we feel that this problem can't be solved without touching the Social Security and the Medicare spending and some of those.
Yeah, I just we have just a short time left in this segment. So rather than going to Alexei for his plan and saying, do it in a minute, I just want to go back on that point that you were making, Jacob. Where did you get your ideas from? I mean, Did you go to, you know, where did you pull some of these new ideas from?
Yeah. So the big, like a lot of the big questions, we start with the CBO long-term budget like options. So there was this big policy sheet that they put out every couple of years where it's like has all kinds of options for reducing the deficit and long-term projections on how to do this. And so we start there. That's the big area where we look to see where we're going to get our policies. And then from there, a lot of people have classes where they get a lot of inspiration from. We had a team member in an economics of immigration class. And we pulled our immigration policy from that and some other classes that we get a lot of inspiration from as well with professors who are actually working on these issues.
Akash, was that true at Temple as well?
Yeah, agreed. I mean, we relied heavily on CBO projections and policy options, but we also intuitively understood what were the biggest major issues holding our economy and our country back. You know, for example, like the looming enrollment cliff, looming trust fund insolvencies, and we incorporated these problems. We said, okay, here's the big issue. What are the ways that we can tackle this?
We'll be right back after these short messages. You're listening to Facing the Future. And we're hearing from some policy ideas from students who recently took part in the finals of the National Fiscal Challenge in Washington. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Phil Smith, Steve Robinson, and I are talking with a group of three students who recently competed in the finals of a fiscal challenge, where the teams put out and defended their plans for fiscal sustainability. And it's an annual competition that's held every year. And so we heard from two of the students in an earlier segment. And now I'm going to go to Alexei Shila from Northeastern University and tell us about your team's plan.
Yes, so this year our plan was a bit based on the IMF paper from 2015 that said that growth policies that are financed by progressive tax reform are very effective, and the revenue side is reinforced by the growth side, and the growth side is also reinforced by the revenue side. So we create kind of like this positive feedback loop. That we're not also raising revenue, but also raising the GDP. And throughout our policy proposal, we also had a lot of productivity enhancements. Specifically, we noticed that there are a lot of government programs that have proven track record of success. However, they are facing, you know, not enough funding, or they've been tried in the past, but since been cut, or they just the funds are being allocated very inefficiently.
And when you went through this to come up with these plans, where did you get your ideas from?
Yes, so our like team's philosophy throughout the years has been that students would take up topics that they're interested in. For instance, we had a student who was also majoring in environmental science, and they also had first had experience with like farms, so they knew firsthand you know what farms entail, and like this instinctive understanding of economics of farms. And they brought it up on one of our meetings saying, you know, there's this thing with indemnity checks that large farms get, and it incentivizes poor soil management. And if we tweak that policy slightly, we could actually, you know, increase long-term crop productivity just because the soil health would be much, much better.
And were there any particular options that you deadlocked over? Or, I mean, any particular decisions that were more difficult than others to arrive at?
Yeah, I think for our team, we don't necessarily disagree on specific policies, because each student goes into very great depth for their specific area of expertise. However, we did have a lot of disagreements on how to combine all of them into a coherent message plot, how to make it all into a nice sort of like combined and comprehensive package that has a common thread.
Yeah, well, that's important too for saleability. So it's not just numbers. And I thought that was really important. It came through in all of them. But I mean, you know, having a theme to the plan rather than just simply going through a CBO cookbook list of options and trying to get the numbers to add up. It's good to have a narrative that go along with the numbers. I mean, what are you trying to do with these numbers in a policy sense and in a standard of living sense, rather than, you know, just having a sustainable fiscal policy, which is nice, but what are you going to do with it? Phil, you were the moderator and saw some of these. You've looked at the plans of all of the various groups. Do you have any questions?
I do. And again, congratulations, first of all, for making the finals. That in itself was huge this year, because Mike tells me it was incredibly competitive across the nation. And I know from my own experience that the best university in the whole country, my alma mater, the University of Georgia, didn't make the cut. So I know if that's the case, there's really some strong proposals going into it. But there were lots of great ones. And of course, we've got the best of the best today, because we've got the top three teams of those finals. And of all of them, one of the most memorable, Jakes, I thought was your Back to the Future proposal. I think if you ask anybody who is sitting in the room most of the time, you know, can you remind yourself of one of the themes? Back to the Future just jumped out. And it's a movie that everybody of all generations, I think, is familiar with. So you successfully tapped into that to kind of show us your plan, and you took it kind of backwards in a way, where you took us to the future and, you know, started in 2054 instead of building up to that. But of all the different parts of your proposal, there was one where my ears really perked up, and that was when you mentioned something about a negative income tax. And I thought that's very interesting, because, of course, you know, as a deficit hawk, I'm always looking for ways to save money over time. And of course, that would cost a little bit of money. But number one, what was the reason for a negative income tax? And could you explain it a little bit? And then what did you have to do to offset the lost revenue that I would guess you would get from a positive income tax?
Yeah, absolutely. So this negative income tax kind of worked in concert with a lot of our other plans, our policies. Specifically, we also, in our policy proposal, implemented a value-added tax, or a VAT. And this is a highly regressive tax, because ultimately it's a tax on consumption, which when you tax consumption, what you're doing is you're taxing people more who spend more of their income on this consumption. So you're taxing people in the lower income levels more as they spend relatively more of their income on the goods that are being taxed. So what we decided to do is, in order to balance out these sort of this regressive VAT tax, is we wanted to give some money back specifically to lower income individuals. And one of the, there's a lot of different ways to do this. You can do tax credits, you can do some sort of subsidy payments, but ultimately a lot of these, or you can do like corporate income tax reductions, but a lot of these end up distorting markets and being distortionary in the overall economic environment. So we went for a straight negative income tax, because what this does is it preserves the incentive to work by essentially, for every dollar you earn under $11,000, you get a dollar and a half, or a dollar and 10 cents, or whatever the plan ends up being. So this continues the incentive to work while giving an extra leg up to people on the lowest income levels. And in order to finance this, we were more aggressive on some of our other policies, specifically the VAT, but we also increased the tax bracket on people on the additional upper level tax brackets, including the highest level, which gives you a lot of income back, especially as you increase this a little more. But we wanted to make sure that we balance this plan out such that everyone making under $100,000 was better off. They were paying less in income taxes, and people making under $50,000 were actually still receiving money from the government. But we balanced this out by increasing taxes on the higher earners to allow for the government to actually, this wouldn't be a tax burden on the government. We actually did make a little bit more money than under the current income plan.
Thank you, Jake. And then Bob, I had a quick question for Akash.
Sure.
And that is, I've spent a lot of my career looking at Social Security proposals. And I noticed in your plan, you were going to raise the age of eligibility to 69. Was that a difficult decision? Did you think about phasing that in over time, or are you going to phase that in pretty quickly, or how would you handle some of the older Americans that might be a little weary of raising that age, because you do get some significant savings from that when you are reforming Social Security, since so many of us are living longer.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And honestly, because life expectancy continues to increase as we have advances in medicine and technology, that is one of the reasons that we felt comfortable raising the retirement, the full benefits age to 69 and indexing it to longevity or life expectancy. It was a difficult decision, though. And while it only affects those born after 1960, that still means that people that are 64 today now only have are getting their full benefits 5 years later instead of 3 years later. And one of the things that we discussed during the Q&A, if you remember, is that while these policies are good for stabilizing the debt to GDP ratio by 2054 under the set of current assumptions, we all know how uncertain the future is. And we incorporated other policies that may balance out these effects so that we don't actually have to add that component. But until we realize that future, we're not going to know. So that's why we had that full set of policies for Social Security.
Steve, you were just meeting with the students in a kind of an informal basis after they had presented. What was your role there?
Well, we euphemistically referred to it as speed dating. So there were a number of other organizations there. There's some folks from the Peterson Institute and I think the Brookings Institute, as well as the Concord Coalition. And essentially, we allowed each of the six teams that were there participating to sort of go around from one table to the next to sort of, you know, introduce ourselves to them and them to us, and give them sort of a sense of, you know, what our background was, how we got involved in public policy, and, you know, give them a sense of, you know, what it's like to work in Washington on public policy issues. So, you know, hopefully the idea is to give them a little better sense of the policy world in Washington, and whether that might be something they would want to do and how they might go about getting involved in that.
Well, there's a never-ending need for that sort of thing in Washington, particularly on fiscal policy. You're listening to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby. Steve Robinson, Phil Smith, and I are talking to Professor Mike Aguilar and three students who recently competed in the annual fiscal challenge that Dr. Aguilar put together several years ago. We'll be right back to discuss more of the students' plans right after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, Concord Coalition Chief Economist Steve Robinson and National Field Director Phil Smith. And I are talking to participants in a recent fiscal challenge competition, which wrapped up in Washington last week. It's where students from all over the country, from different universities and colleges, come together with their own plans, and they have to defend these before a panel of experts. And then they're judged, and we have representatives from three of the teams that did really well this year, including the winning team from Temple University. Let me turn now to Steve Robinson for a question for the students.
Okay, so I'm going to sort of throw this open to everybody, because I'm looking for advice. So what we do here at the Concord Coalition is among other things, is try to educate the public about the need for a more fiscally responsible federal government. And it's always a challenge. I mean, the interest in budget deficits and debt has sort of waxed and waned over the years. There used to be somewhat of a bipartisan consensus that, yeah, we had to address entitlements and we had to do something on tax reform. And so there was more of a broader bipartisan consensus. And that's pretty much broken down in recent years. And so I guess my question is, you know, as a college student, I guess two questions. Sort of, what do not the fellow students who are on your team, but when you tell just sort of other random students, like, what have you been doing? What are you working on? You know, do you get a sense from other students that they sort of get it, that yeah, maybe the budget is in trouble and we need to do something about it? And if they do, or perhaps if they don't get it, What advice would you have for maybe us and other groups like the Conquer Coalition? How would we get college students more engaged in trying to address the needs of our nation's fiscal policy?
I can start. Well, talking to, you know, college students, often you get the sense that there's no sense of urgency. Because, for instance, with Social Security, there's this attitude, oh, they're going to come up with something when the time comes, so I'm not worried about it. Or there's a pessimistic attitude as well, which is, I won't have my retirement, so why worry? I feel that explaining, in my experience, explaining what exactly is going to happen if we don't fix Social Security, for instance, to their parents, first of all, but second, to their own retirement, because if they cannot take into account the potential Social Security income, you know, it becomes quite a bit harder. Now, it means, of course, they should also save for their retirement, but Social Security is an important part to stabilize, you know, any short gaps that might arise in the future. But I feel that pointing out the effects on their personal lives really helps, sort of like asking them to imagine themselves in 40 years being without Social Security.
Yeah, kind of just to echo that is when I bring up the fiscal challenge and what I'm doing, a lot of people are like, really, it takes a lot of explaining to get to people what actually I'm doing here, what actually, you know, they think congressional policy, people often think of like political or social issues. They aren't necessarily thinking about the economic ones. So a lot of what I think our club tries to do in terms of like when we're talking to students about, you know, what this club does and why this is important is why economic issues in themselves are important, specifically these issues of the debt. And I think a big part of that is the interest payments. And I think kind of one of the big things that gets a lot of people really interested in this and why a lot of the members of our club get interested in this and really become passionate about the debt as an issue is this idea that ultimately on interest, you're spending a huge portion of the US budget paying for previous things rather than investing in the future or investing in the kinds of things that you want to see in your society. So the idea is like, you have all these great ideas, all these college students have a whole bunch of great things they want to do with the country and with the future, but those things, they need financing. And if we keep finance sort of pushing all our spending forward, we won't have any ability to spend for the next generation of great ideas. So I think a good way to reach out to people and to talk to people about this is to help them understand sort of the magnitude of the consequences of not dealing with this issue and how things keep piling up.
Yeah, Jake, you just put it so well. The fact that with an increasingly unsustainable budget, we have less money to spend on really important discretionary spending activities that could really, like that universal childcare proposal that you had, like that is money that we need, it needs to come from somewhere. And a lot of, if you talk to a lot of college students, they're either highly idealistic or they're highly pessimistic about our future. And I think one of the biggest things in connecting with college students is making them feel heard and just making them feel like, yeah, my desires and my dream and my future for myself is valuable, is it like someone cares about it. And it's not just a bunch of powers that be talking about my future without me being in the room and without me having any say. Like someone actually cares about making sure that myself and my kids can afford to go to college, or that myself and my kids can move upward on the socioeconomic ladder. And that's something that I think is really lacking. It's not just about educating, it's also about listening.
You know, one of the things that occurs to me, it's an election year. We don't talk about that on this show. But, you know, however the elections come out, the politician is going to have to deal with these things. I think of three events. You know, just in 2025, the debt ceiling is going to go back into effect. The current spending caps that we have on appropriations are going to expire. And the tax cuts that were enacted in 2017 are going to expire all in 1 year. All that happens in 2025. So I think fiscal policy plays a bigger sense in how people think about things than they may realize, because they're running for office and they're going to have all these things. Steve asked, you know, what advice you would have for the Concord Coalition and others. What advice would you have for people running for office? I mean, how do you talk about these things without getting your head chopped off? How would you frame it?
If I may, this is something that I've thought a lot about because it's hard. It's hard when you're constantly in this cycle of I need to win the next election. My future and my career depends on winning the next election. It's hard to get political leaders to step outside of their comfort zones and the comfort zones of their voters. But ultimately, what I would say, if I could get in a room with people running for office and sit down with them and say, here's what Americans want. Americans want to feel safe, and they want the freedom to be loved. And that those are the two major components that even if you approach these major issues like Social Security and Medicare, if you can show your constituents that they are going to be safe and that they're going to be able to be loved, those are the two most important things. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah.
Adding on to that, I think the one of the big things that you need to tell the sort of politicians is that the future is something that's very important to not just young voters, but I think to all voters who have some sense of either, I want my kids to have a future, I want to have a future myself. And I think that something that is really important to connect with on politicians is that a lot of people in college age and everywhere have this sort of either this really idealism about the future or this real pessimism, as Akash was saying, and that we need to reach out to people and tell, sort of convince them that there is this, I get them more on this idealistic side, that there is hope for this future and that there are these ideas that can get there. Now, while they may be a little bit more painful now, it is about making trade-offs now for the future rather than trading the now, rather than trading what like for better now and worse in the future.
You know, one thing just to wrap up here, I was giving a talk recently at a school, at the University of New Hampshire. And, you know, one of the problems is you show a lot of slides and everything, and then you worry that the students may absorb it and decide there's nothing we can do about this. We're really in trouble. Because, you know, I there were a lot of people that, you know, after the event came up to me and my fellow panelists, kind of worried about that. It was, you know, a lot of it was new information for them. They weren't really aware of the magnitude of this problem. And the great thing about this fiscal competition is that you're obviously going beyond that. I mean, you're taking the bull by the horns and coming up with some actual solutions. And so it gets beyond the despair of here it is, because you know, I think we should end on an optimistic note with all of this, and your plans prove it, which is that if we do these things, we're going to have a better economy in the future. We're going to have a sustainable Social Security system, which people, you know, may not be thinking about right now, but they will be in the future. We're going to have better health care. We're going to have a bigger, faster growing population. All of these ideas would, and we're going to have a safer climate. So, you know, there are positive outcomes here. And you know, your generation really, I wish my generation had not left you with such a mess, but we did. So I really am glad to see that there are positive contributions that that can be made. Mike, let me just go to you. Any wrap-up thoughts?
In terms of optimism, one of the things that I've been noticing, not at the college level, but high school and middle school, financial literacy training. It's becoming more and more prolific. And I think part of what the students mentioned before was that there's an understanding problem. There's awareness, there's myopia, but there's a misunderstanding. So the more that little kids understand discounting, understand this notion of interest rates, the more they'll be able to appreciate these problems later on.
And Mike, well, I'll try to get you a University of New Hampshire team next year. So
please, please.
I may have to recuse myself if that happens, but anyway. Okay, well, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you for your listening. I'm your host, Bob Bixby, and you've been listening to Facing the Future. We've been talking to three students who recently competed in the Fiscal Challenge competition trying to come up with plans that would stabilize the debt to GDP ratio. And we really, really appreciate their work. Thanks also to Mike Aguilar, the founder and president of the Fiscal Challenge, and to my colleagues, Phil Smith and Steve Robinson. Tune in again next week for another edition of Facing the Future.